letters that we have per person, if I may sir. The latest information we have is that the court has extended the final liquidation order to some time in August this year. Now, members would ask a question as to what has been happening all along until today. What has the department been doing? Chairperson raised this question in his opening remarks. What has the department been doing to ensure that where there are transgressions on the law, what have we been doing? Chairperson, we have engaged extensively with the liquidators as well as the management at the mine when the mine was still operational. We will talk to that also as we move with the presentation. The department was informed that the liquidators and the management contractor cannot meet any of the mine's financial obligations. And at that point, that is when then our colleagues from Health and Safety then recommended that the mine be placed on care and maintenance. My colleague David will explain in detail why did we arrive at that decision, because it was more to ensure the health and safety of the workers at the mine. This slide touches on the water and environmental issues, Chairperson. And as we go through the slide, we will also highlight our interventions, both on the environmental issues as well as on the matters relating to the liquidation. Historically, the pumping capacity at Grootvlei, and the reason why, Chairperson, we chose in our presentation to focus maybe in detail on Grootvlei and not necessarily on Orkney, is that both Orkney and Grootvlei are in a similar situation because they are owned by this one company called Phamozi, which is under provisional liquidation. But one distinguishing factor with Grootvlei is that Grootvlei has these other challenges, for example, the challenge relating to the rising water or the acid mine water. With time, this capacity to pump at that rate at 110 megalitres per day diminished due to poor online maintenance of the pumping infrastructure. The department, now coming to address the question that was posed by the chairperson earlier on, the department did intervene as early as March last year on the water, specifically water-related issues. We came up with a number of interventions where, Chairperson, we had meetings with the provisional liquidators. We have emails and letters that we were sending back and forth to the liquidators, inviting them for meetings. We had meetings throughout the year in October, and at all these meetings, every time we were engaging with the liquidators, they would inform us of the extension on the final liquidation order. One major issue that we also focused on is the transgressions on the environmental matters at all these meetings, such that at one of our meetings, which we held on the 25th of October, the provisional joint liquidators were represented by Mr. Baron Peterson and Mr. Enver Mutala, and they also brought with them the management contractor, Aurora Empowerment System. And at that meeting, we explained to the person in detail as to what should be happening, and the liquidators undertook to do or implement those measures relating to sorting out the environmental issues, the water challenges that had been raised, and quite a number of other issues were raised at that meeting. And we did not stop there, Chairperson. On the very same day, we issued a Section 93 order in terms of the MPRDA, instructing the liquidators to take certain corrective measures. And prior to that order, still Chairperson, there had been a number of letters that were written to the provisional joint liquidators and they have acknowledged that they were receiving those letters, where we were spelling out what they need to be doing, their obligations in terms of the terms and conditions of the rights that had been issued to Phamotsi, as it were. At that point, specifically at that meeting of the 25th, Chairperson, they did share with us that they were pumping, they were still pumping at that stage, but there were questions around the level of treatment. What we then did following that meeting, we had another meeting with the Department of Water Affairs, and we agreed on a joint inspection. At that joint inspection, we took with us even the Council for Geoscience, where they took samples, and Water Affairs also took samples of the water, and we tested the water, and indeed, the quality of the water was not of acceptable standard. We then instructed them to take corrective measures on that, and they indeed took corrective measures, and we requested proof and invoices indicating that they had bought lime and other chemicals for water treatment at that point. And the details of all of this is contained in the order that we did issue to the provisional liquidators. Currently, Chairperson, over and above that, on the subsidy, sorry if I may just cover this one point. On the subsidy, the company Aurora applied to the department for the pumping subsidy. And we called another meeting with the liquidators where they came with Aurora Empowerment Systems, and we explained, we clarified this legal relationship that exists between us and the provisional liquidators by virtue of Phamotsi being under provisional liquidators, as opposed to us receiving an application or applications from Aurora Empowerment Systems. At that stage, we could not do anything with that application. That was explained to them. We explained the procedure. We explained that the claim or the application for the subsidy ought to come from the joint provisional liquidators by virtue of them being the curators until the final liquidation order is issued, Chairperson. They indeed took the documents back. And I must say, the documents, the claim at that point related to the quarter October to December 2009. They rectified that, and the claim was then submitted to the department. We evaluated the claim, and an amount of 3 million rands was paid into the account of the provisional joint liquidators as the assistance in terms of the subsidy for pumping and treatment of water. A claim that followed after that one that was submitted again by the joint provisional liquidators did not meet the set criteria. I will talk to the criteria on the next slide, Chairperson. And hence, that claim could not be paid. While still on this, Chairperson, I think it's important for us to share with this committee this morning that the subsidy that we are talking about is not an entitlement. And I must say, I found it very disturbing when I heard the representative of Aurora Empowerment System saying that they had billed the subsidy amount in their cash flow statements. I find it puzzling that how does one get into a business and budget on a subsidy from the government, which subsidy is not an entitlement. We have seen also, Chairperson, over the past few months that there have been allegations that the Department of Mineral Resources owes us money for the subsidy. The subsidy is not an entitlement. The department does not owe anybody any money. Chairperson, when the criteria, when the pumping subsidy was approved by Cabinet in 1967, Cabinet set out a certain criteria within which the department would consider applications for the pumping subsidy. And the criteria is such that the subsidy is applicable only to critically marginal mines. The subsidy is for mines to pump extraneous water, and the mine applying for the subsidy at that point must be in a short-term crisis, not inherently sustainable and not dependent on aid, on state aid for it to survive or to continue operating. And the mine must be faced with imminent closure if not assisted. But I think the most critical one, Chairperson, is that this subsidy is only applicable to operational mines. And we all know, Chairperson, that this mine that we're talking about, Rotflay Mine, has not been operational since March last year. That is why on the claim that I spoke about earlier on that we could not process, one of the reasons, in fact, one of the requirements or the documents that they need to submit to us is that they need to submit production figures for that quarter that they are applying for a subsidy. To date, the department still does not have those production figures because they were not operational at that point. The mine was not producing at that point. And the other aspect is that no other expenses other than pumping costs are to be claimed or are to form part of the application. I'm emphasizing, Chairperson, that this is an application. You apply for the subsidy. It is not an entitlement. It is not a given. And we have explained this over and over and over in meetings to the provisional liquidators. Just moving away then from the liquidation and the pumping and the application for the subsidy, Chairperson. We've just drawn up a sketch which seeks to indicate the situation at the mine. I hope it's visible enough on the slides, on the handouts that we have circulated. This is where the pump was, Chairperson. I'm sure we heard from the presentation made by Solidarity this morning that the pump has been moved up to surface. That is true, and the department was informed of that. But by the time we were informed of that, we had already taken measures on the health and safety side, which measures the Chief Inspector of Mines will talk to. At the pump station was located at that point, which is roughly about 750-780 below surface. Because of the integrity of the pump itself and the columns used to pump the water up to the surface, not being of the desired condition, it was happening that as the pumping was being done, some of the water would flow back into that space, into the pump chamber where the pump is. And the first thing we raised as a department when we visited, we went on another site inspection in February. The issue we raised was that if the pump is there and there's a plug just below the pump and people are sent down there to operate the pump with water leaking back into the pump chamber, there could be an accident where people would not be able to escape. At that point, we made it very clear that no one is to be sent down there because of the safety issues or the risks that go with that. An undertaking was made that the pumps would then be moved up to where it says on the, I think on the handouts, UK3 level as an interim measure, where then at a later stage there could be options to look at even putting down submersible pumps to bring the water level back to where it originally was or where it still is. So this chairperson, we did this just to illustrate what the situation was and why we had to take the drastic step or decision to say, because one might argue and say, but if the pump then comes out, then it means the pumping had to stop. Yes, it had to stop because of the situation at that particular shaft where the pump is situated. We couldn't continue, we couldn't risk the lives of people where people would descend down there on a daily basis, knowing that the whole infrastructure for the pumping is not in a good condition. That's where we are, Chairperson, at this moment. But maybe before I hand over to my colleague, just to say that that Section 93 order that we issued, some of the things that were in the order were complied with, some of them are still outstanding. And that is why we had them to follow up in February and do that inspection and then take a decision that let's place the mine on care and maintenance. May I, Chairperson, hand over to Mr. Msiza?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, members, colleagues. Once again, good day. My name is David Msiza. I'm the acting chief inspector of mines. I think when we received information that there were financial problems on the Pamozi mine, including the Hlotsley and the Omni mine, we engaged the relevant management and also the liquidators, and again with our other stakeholders, including the union guys, are ready to discuss on some of the challenges that we foresee. But at the same time, we decided to conduct audits on the payments of creditors, especially those who are providing health and safety services at those mines. I mean, it became apparent to us that rock engineers are consulted out, which in some of the mines it's a normal issue that is taking place. But I think it was very, very important that those people are paid, and including rock engineers and equipment providers, because historically we had challenges where people are not getting paid and they are not providing the services, and then safety suffers. But I think with the engagements, then it became apparent that due to the financial problems, the health and safety of the employees was becoming compromised. And at the same time, we continuously done inspections, especially with the Hlotsley mines, where they were actually doing pumping. One of the legal requirements is that now and again, the mine must do what we call statutory inspection. Statutory inspections includes like things like doing your inspections of the shaft itself, and also the winding equipment that is being used in that particular shaft. And at one stage, we've checked records to ensure that it's really taking place. And we found that there was no proof that some of the ropes were tested in terms of the law. And then we, obviously, the law gives us the power to take the necessary actions. We issued a Section 54 instruction to stop all the respective shafts until there is proof. We've done that because, for us, you know, any risk that has to do with winding or shaft is very, we take it in a very serious matter. You can imagine if an accident happened with 100 people or 20 people in a cage, and we really take that seriously. Until those tests were done, then we allowed the mine to continue operating. But another issue that we had a concern with was the integrity of the water column for pumping at our Hlotsley. Because we were told now and again that they had to do some welding of the column. So all that spoke to the integrity of the column itself, and we raised that as a concern. And again, as my colleague has indicated, there should be a secondary outlet for any person who goes underground. It's law that for to send underground, there shouldn't be a secondary outlet. And hence, he really indicated that we have had to issue an instruction to say, if they are not afforded a secondary outlet, then it will be unsafe for them to continue doing the work that we requested. As indicated earlier on, I think when we engage with management as well, it became apparent to us that the safety of the employees cannot be guaranteed, and we issued the relevant instructions. And another advice that we have granted to them was that they should place the mine under care and maintenance on health and safety related matters. Because now if you're going to send people underground and it's unsafe, then you're putting them in harm's way. So lastly, on that particular slide, the mine is still under care and maintenance until it comes back to normality. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, just moving to the concluding remarks, one of the challenges that we are faced with is that the laws regarding liquidations to a certain extent have our hands tied. At this point, we have done a number of things. We have taken certain measures. We have taken certain decisions, which decisions at some point we realize are not necessarily desirable. For example, when we had to take that decision that no more, no one should go underground there, you know, one raises a question or an issue of the workers' employment, people who were working there, but also there are issues which have been raised this morning of them not being paid anyway. But those are the kinds of issues that we get confronted with, that at some point, for health and safety reasons, we have to stop operations to prioritize the health and safety of the workers at that particular mine. And really for us, the decider here is that final liquidation order, because then it would enable us to say the situation being what it is at that point, at the point of the final liquidation order being issued. The assessment of the mine, the question was asked this morning that is it a mine at all? Is it still worth operating? That assessment can be done. Currently, the water level where it is, we do believe that it's still under control. And one good thing, Chairperson, that has put us in a better position or is buying us time currently is the fact that we have gone past the rainy season. So the rate at which the water rises has slowed down a bit. We are constantly monitoring water. We are doing that with the Council for Geoscience. They have monitoring stations in different points in the East Rand. So on a daily basis, we know what the rate is at which the water is rising. And our latest readings, Chairperson, tell us that the water is rising at about 400 to 500 millimeters per day. And that's really because of the fact that we've gone past the rainy season. And the decanting that has been happening, which then increases that rate, which pushes up the rate, has been controlled there. But all I'm saying is that assessment can be done, and once done, then we will be able to say what interventions can we come up with. And the last issue, Chairperson, that we're also citing is to say there are a number of options. Either the mine could operate if proven that it's still in a condition for anyone to go there. But also, it's public knowledge that the IMC on acid mine drainage, which was set up and comprises of cabinet ministers, in that report, we had in that report, together with experts from different institutions, our SOEs, made certain recommendations for certain things to be done in the Vets Basin. So all we're saying here is this mine, Fort Flay, is in the eastern sub-basin, which is within the Vets Basin. So it's not excluded. It's not out of that arrangement or out of that those recommendations that were made to the IMC. that also is one intervention that we are looking at as we continue to monitor the situation. And that chairperson brings us to the end of our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, TMR. Again, with you, we will keep to our decision that we will hold the comments and questions, and let's move on straight to the Department of Labor to give us their input.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairpersons of the Labor Portfolio Committee and the Minerals Portfolio Committee members, colleagues. With me, I have a team of department officials. My name is Sam Rotova, the Acting Director General. I have the Chief Financial Officer, the Chief Inspector, Mr. Lamati. I have Advocate Bastille, the person who was dealing with the case in the both Bokni and Crossley. I have the Chief Director, Northwest, Mr. Makapela, Advocate Pasha, Ms. Yanda Zonetti, the DDG Inspection Enforcement Services, and Mr. Chris Mill from the Unemployment Insurance Fund. Now, my presentation will cover mainly four aspects. I'll be very brief on the background because most of the aspects were covered already by other colleagues relating to the problems at Aurora. I'll give a sense in terms of the legislative mandate and the basis of our involvement in the whole Aurora problem, and I'll update members on the interventions that we've made and what is the current situation, and I will then conclude with some remarks. On the background, I think different dates were mentioned around when this problem started, except that when it initially came to our attention, our labor inspectors did a number of things, and we have documented evidence of meetings that were held at various levels to try and resolve the problem. With respect to Aurora, the problem I think came as early as July 2009 and Orkney September. And the issues that were raised I think are common knowledge. They relate to unpaid wages, overtime. NUMSA at some stage raised the question of monies that were borrowed from the agency shop fund that were not paid, and issues that Solidarity covered to a certain extent, including NUM, around deductions that were made and monies that were not paid over. I think the initial stage to try and resolve this problem could not succeed, partly because every time our inspectors intervened, we had a sense that there was no seriousness on the employer side to honor the agreement, and we also spent quite some time consulting with the employers, NUM, Solidarity, and employees, as members may know, that some members may not necessarily be part of any unions. And some of the agreements that were being made, depending on who you meet, were just not enforceable. And in some cases, the information that we're collecting without proper structures was not sufficient so that we can come up with a solid case. We then started an internal process led by Advocate Bastille in the department, where we went through our legislation and we wanted to assist inspectors and to bring this matter to finality. And I just wanted to refer to a number of sections. Section 32 of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act has to do with the whole question of payment of wages. Now, it's clear that in Aurora, there's a breach of this section. Secondly, we looked at the powers that the inspectors can enforce. Now, this is common knowledge that throughout the inspections that we have, the powers of the inspectors of the Department of Labor are limited to securing and undertaking. And in terms of the BCA, our inspectors could only act in terms of this provision and in relation to wages. And I must also indicate that as for the general inspections within the mining industry, those fall within the jurisdiction of the Minerals and Energy, and they are outside of the scope of the department. We also looked at the Section 59, which we can invoke, because this provides the inspectors with powers to issue a compliance order, and if an employer does not comply, we can still apply to the labor court to make that compliance order an order of court in terms of the Labor Relations Act. But notwithstanding the above, I must also indicate that the powers of the Dole inspectors are limited because when it comes to areas where there is a collective bargaining agreement, inspectors of the department cannot intervene, or they have to make sure that whatever they do, that is in line with the various collective agreement. And this explains why the initial process took long, because whilst we tried to intervene, we found that there were a number of agreements that were signed between NUM and Solidarity in between. And secondly, those workers that fall outside of a threshold that is earning an amount that is above 149,000 are also excluded, and the inspectors cannot intervene, and I'll talk to that issue. And the other thing was that in terms of Aurora, we could also intervene under the Unemployment Insurance Act to pay their benefits in terms of the unemployment insurance, because of the deductions that were made have been made. So notwithstanding the fact that we did find in that process also these issues of deductions having been made and money is not being passed on. Now, having said that, one of the other things that also delayed the process, I think you have had a number of presentations, and I won't go into all these issues because we found ourselves being involved or you know, participating in discussions that almost distracted our focus. And most of these issues are real. We cannot shy away from them, but they have nothing to do with the department. And one is not saying they are not serious. They are matters of serious concern to employees at Aurora, issues around the liquidation, the ownership, licensing, those collective agreements, etc. And I need to clarify this issue around the threshold, because the basic conditions of employment is meant to protect workers that ordinarily find it very difficult to have unions or where their rights have to be protected in terms of the minimum floor. And the Act puts, we have a determination that set the threshold at 149,575. So workers earning below this amount or up to this amount are those workers that we can intervene on their behalf, and workers earning above that amount per annum, the Act does not allow us to intervene on their behalf, and that is why Solidarity indicated that they are pursuing further legal obligations. And we have issues around those migrant workers who have left. I think the Solidarity slide, to a certain extent, gave you a sense of the living conditions. We have had a side to that, and in the Labour Portfolio Committee, there were suggestions that we coordinate processes with social development and other related departments, such as minerals, resources, and so on, that we continue to do. And to make sure that all of us play our part with respect to those areas that fall within our jurisdiction. I think security problems were also mentioned. Now, in line with the BCA, we did do our task. Initially, we at the Aurora crossplay, we came to the conclusion based on the information that we had that the total amount of money owed to workers was 4 million. This excludes the Ogni mine, which is 8.6. And out of that, the only intervention that we could make was on behalf of the 1,238 workers that earned below the threshold, and the total amount of money owed to them was 2.03 million. And we subsequently issued a compliance order after the employer failed to give us an undertaking that they will pay those amounts. And when the employer failed to comply with the order, we then approached the Labour Court during November 2010 for that compliance order to be made an order of court. Now, because of that, and in response to the court instruction, Aurora then transferred an amount of 2.3 million to the department's account. And this is provided for under Section 68C of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, where the department, after securing an order, can get this money and assist in the facilitation of payment. And this is the only amount of money that the department received from Aurora and nothing else. And we then made arrangements to proceed to pay all these workers at Springs. Obviously, we're using the information that we collected before the compliance order was filed, and verifying that information with Aurora files as well. The Springs Labor Center officials had to work during the festive season, starting from the 13th of December, all the way right through the festive season, to ensure that workers are paid out their amount. We talked to Crossplay to give us their premises because of security concerns, which they complied, and we dispatched people from head office. Our CFO led the team, and we did have NUM shop steward participating and overseeing the process. And we also invited the police to assist us in the process because of the security concerns. Now, during the first payment on the 15th, 16th, and 17th of December, a total of 750 715 workers, which represents 57.8% of the workers we had, received an amount of 765,000 in cash. And we then made arrangements to continue paying other workers that could not make it. And I must say that during the payment, all sorts of problems were experienced because, you know, instead of workers that were on the compliance order, additional workers, some that were not even on the list turned up. But we made arrangements to make sure that beyond that period, those workers that could not come in are paid. We noted a total of 300 workers that were on the original list that is on the compliance order that did not come at the road flay industry, and there were amongst them 50 workers. I don't know whether it's because of overtime and all that, whose amount or the amounts that were due to them were in excess of 10,000 rand each. And to accommodate those workers that did not make it, we made arrangements for the office to continue operating beyond the 20th of December. We had to cancel leave of employees so that the office can remain open. And that because of the number of people who were turning up after learning that the department is assisting in terms of payments, that we make room to hear those cases of new claims. And I'm sure honorable members will know that where there is money, you can't rule other elements that will also come in to say that we are owed. And we ask them to also submit the full documents and all that, so that if there's a case, we can then take it up with Aurora. Now, briefly, since December 2010 to the 15th of March, an additional 217 workers were assisted with check or electronic payments, and 291 workers must still contact the Department of Labor to claim their monies. And this may be workers that are outside of the country because they may have left the country and so on, or they are not aware of the process, or they may have found employment or died somewhere, etc. And that in the process, an additional 493 new cases have been recorded. Those are the people that I said came up, and we will then take all those cases. That is the 493 where we believe that they may be having a case, and then follow the same procedure that we followed of compiling an order. Now, just to give you a sense in terms of how the 2.03 million. Transferred to the department was used, is that up to December, 787 was paid, 443 by end of January, 366,000 by end of February, and by end of March, an additional 388,000, and a total of 1.9 million has been paid, and what we are left with is 45,700 in the trust fund. That has been created, and this is for workers earning below the threshold. As for those workers that earn above threshold, those processes solidarity did indicate that they are pursuing that matter at court. And this slide I can skip, but this was just to give you a sense that we also used all resources because we had staff involved to augment those funds because we had to provide services such as security overtime payment for our staff. And with regards to not be processed, because technically these workers were still employed by UIS, by Aurora, and therefore could not pay. But we have since had meetings with the workers to clarify the process and the procedures to be followed. And from the meetings and the records that we have, the current estimation is that we are sitting with a potential 3,000 claimants, and so far we have received 800 applications as of the 22nd of March. And with respect to these employees, in order for us to start payments, we need declarations from the employers, and this is still outstanding. We had a meeting with Aurora on the 22nd of March to try and find a common ground on UI, and a number of agreements were reached, and I won't go through those because those are basically the procedures that will actually assist in effecting payments. So those points were agreed to, and we are going to meet on the 15th of April just to review the progress with regards to the UIF payment. Now, that was crossplay. With OCNI, we started this process only in October 2010, and the total amount owed to 1,170 employees, of which 185 have since resigned, was 8.6 million rand. And during December, when we were in the process of providing because we failed to get an undertaking from the employer, whilst we were busy compiling a compliance order, Aurora decided to effect a payment which equals to about 25% of the total amount owed to employees at the OCNI plant. Now, the colleague from NUM says the department suddenly withdrew the case, and I think maybe it's just an understanding of the legal process, because if the department files a compliance order saying that this amount is owed, only to find that through their legal advice, Aurora paid X amount, that compliance order becomes invalid because the amount of money that you stated is incorrect, and therefore you have to then withdraw that compliance order in order to revise the amount and to resubmit. So this is what happened in this case, and has nothing to do with the department suddenly withdrawing the compliance order. And we have submitted this compliance order on the 15th of February, and this is with respect to those workers earning below the threshold, demanding a payment of 3.95 million. And up to now, we know that Aurora failed to comply with the compliance order, and they have not raised any objection to the department. And we then proceeded to submit this compliance order to the Labor Court on the 12th of April. And we have since secured a case number, and we are going to submit all the papers to Aurora by not later than Monday, the 18th of April. And if then the process will then follow. And maybe this is the context within which Aurora was saying that they were waiting for papers. And this process will then follow, like what we have done in Crossplay. Just some concluding remarks. Honorable members will note that the involvement of Dole just on this one aspect around outstanding wages has been a very, very complex one, given all other matters that have nothing to do with wages, but are very critical and very important, and if not resolved, will continue to impact on the payment of wages. Secondly, I think we did outline all those factors that continue to impact on this process that we do not have jurisdiction over. Thirdly, we are very much committed, and we have actually put our officials out there, both in the Northwest and in Gauteng, Klerksdorp, to continue to work with the unions, both NUM, Solidarity, NUMSA, and so on, to trace those workers who could not come and claim their money, those migrant workers, and so on, so that they can get their money as we get this 3.9 million that they get paid. And I did outline the unemployment insurance benefit. As soon as we get those declarations from the employer, the UIF machinery is actually ready to commence with payment. Now, given a whole range of aspects that affect Aurora, we are only one department in a number of other departments, such as justice, minerals, the police, and so on, to solve this problem. And the department, despite our commitments, we depend on the cooperation, wisdom, and assistance of unions, the Aurora management, the Labor Portfolio Committee, the Mineral Resources Portfolio Committee, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Affairs, and other related departments, if we're to change the lives of Aurora mine workers. And in terms of our processes, whilst we are monitoring the process, we will conduct again a very detailed, extensive review during September, after we've gone through the payments, just to check if there are still outstanding payments and so on, and other matters that we could not resolve. And the Labor Portfolio Committee has also requested that we, on a periodical basis, brief them on the developments in this regard. And I want to thank you for giving us an opportunity to brief you on our part in the Aurora case. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Department of Labor. We will do the same with you. We will withhold the questions. And let's receive the submission of the last stakeholder in this regard, SPT Trust, which I will take it that it's liquidators. Set yourselves up, and if you're going to use the machines, are there copies for this presentation that you are going to be giving us?
Mr. Chairperson, unfortunately not, but I'll ensure that an adequate copy is sent to you. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, Madam Secretary, and Honourable Members. First and foremost, I would just like to place on record that on the 6th of April, I personally received a letter from this Honourable Committee for an invitation to brief the Committee on the developments and crisis in the Aurora operations, both in Orkney and the Crowdflay mines. Now, of crucial importance is the fact that in both these mines, they are joint provisional liquidators, and in terms of the Insolvency Act and the Companies Act, joint provisional liquidators have to act exactly jointly. No one single liquidator can make any decisions on his own. In fact, on the East Rand operations, there are 6 joint provisional liquidators that are appointed, and 2 of the joint provisional liquidators on the East Rand are union-nominated liquidators, one nominated by Solidarity and the other nominated by NUM. So at all times, the joint provisional liquidators, they took decisions in consultation with the major creditors. Now, it is very important before I start briefing you to explain to you the mechanics of the Insolvency Act and the Companies Act. In terms of the relevant provisions of the Insolvency Act and the Companies Act, joint, provisional, or final liquidators have to act within the confines of both those acts. They are not a law unto themselves, notwithstanding the suggestions that have been made, which I dismiss completely out of hand, that Aurora Empowerment Systems is being favored. The liquidators have to take instructions from the major secured creditors. In this instance, as far as East Rand is concerned, the major secured creditor is one of the largest European banks, UniCredit Bank, that has an exposure on East Rand Komotsi in liquidation to an extent of over R1 billion. As far as the Orkney operations are concerned, the major secured creditor there is the Industrial Development Corporation that has an exposure in excess of over R200 million. So I want to make it absolutely clear that no one liquidator can take a decision on his own. Having received this letter, I invited my joint provisional liquidators to attend this hearing, and the response that I got from them is that, no, the request was made to you, Mr. Motala, and not to us. Therefore, you must attend the hearing. I have absolutely no problem with that because I have got a full and comprehensive report to give you. To start off with, I'd like to give the House a brief overview of where this entire matter started, how the companies went into liquidation, and I will try and be as quick as I can.
Chairperson, can I just ask a question? Do we have this report in writing, or is it just a verbal
report? It is in writing, and copies have not been made, but I will arrange for that to be forwarded to the chairperson. The background information is, Komotsi Gold Orkney was placed in provisional liquidation on the 20th of March 2009 by order of the North Gauteng High Court Pretoria, pursuant to an application having been launched by a creditor, Engineering Labour Hire and Mining Supply CC. Pursuant to PGO being, and I will refer to Komotsi Orkney as PGO. Pursuant to PGO being placed into provisional liquidation, the Master of the North Gauteng High Court issued a certificate of provisional appointment dated 21st of March 29, appointing myself, Enver Motala, Mr. Alan David Pello, and Mr. Dion Marius Botha as the joint provisional liquidators. On the 23rd of March 2009, the North Gauteng High Court Pretoria, under case number 15514 of 09, granted an extension of powers order pursuant to us as joint provisional liquidators, having launched an ex parte application for our powers to be extended to enable us to deal with the assets of Komotsi Gold Orkney in the best interest of the general body of creditors. I pause here just to explain to you that the powers of joint provisional liquidators are by law somewhat limited as to the powers of joint final liquidators. Therefore, we had to approach court in consultation with the creditors to have our powers extended. On the 17th of April 2009, Komotsi Gold East Rand Pty Limited in liquidation, a Nigel gold mining company in provisional liquidation, Consolidated Modderfontein Mines 1979 in provisional liquidation, the Kloofontein Proprietary Mines in provisional liquidation, and Consolidated Modderfontein Mines in provisional liquidation, hereinafter collectively referred to as the East Rand companies, were all placed into provisional liquidation, also by order of the North Gauteng High Court. Pursuant to the East Rand companies having been placed into provisional liquidation, the Master of the High Court in Pretoria issued certificates of provisional appointments dated 20th of April 29, appointing myself, Mr. Alan David Pello, Mr. Baron Peterson, the representative of NUM, Mr. Johann Francois Engelbrecht, the representative of Solidarity, Cecil Gainsford, and Mr. Dion Marius Botha as joint provisional liquidators of the East Rand operations. The applicants to the various winding up applications heard on the 17th of April prayed that their powers of the provisional liquidators to be appointed be extended to enable the joint provisional liquidators once appointed to deal with the assets of the East Rand companies in the best interest of the general body of creditors. The joint provisional liquidators to be appointed powers and their powers were so extended. It is under these extended powers that the joint provisional liquidators have administered the estates of the East Rand companies. And I pause here to mention that the JPLs, as I call them, have did nothing in this estate unless they were empowered and authorized to do so by court. Upon taking control of the East Rand companies, it was immediately apparent that the companies had, prior to their provisional liquidation, been run as a group. This was so, notwithstanding that only Hurtley owned a gold mine. Accordingly, it was necessary to treat the companies as a group and not individually, as they are inextricably linked. Since taking control of the various estates, the joint provisional liquidators have been intimately involved, literally on a daily basis, in administering them in an attempt to ensure the best possible outcome for the general body of creditors. The exercise of our duties has been not only extremely time-consuming but also particularly complicated as a result of the quantum involved, the complexity of the business of Pomotri Gold Orkney and East Rand companies, and the conflicting stakeholder interests at play. These interests include but are not limited to worker interests, trade union interests, creditor interests, and the interest and the interest of certain governmental departments, for example, the DMR and the Department of Water. Pursuant to intensive investigations by us and upon advice from our advisors, we concluded, and in consultation with the major secured creditors, I may say, that it would be in the best interest of the general body of creditors if a buyer for all the assets of PGO and East Rand companies, alternatively, a party would be interested in conducting a scheme of arrangement in terms of Section 311 of the Companies Act could be found. This was so because the sale of the assets in a piecemeal fashion would, in the view of the joint provisional liquidators and the secured creditors, yield a significantly lower return to the estate. It is important to note that the underlying value of PGO and the East Rand operations lies in the mining rights, and not just the physical assets. And I want to stress this. Without the mining rights, we have nothing to sell. And I'll come to that shortly. Accordingly, the joint provisional liquidators wanted to sell the mining rights as well as the tangible assets to maximize the returns to creditors. It should also be noted that if the East Rand companies, particularly Kroetvlei, are allowed to be placed into final winding up, then the mining licenses will automatically lapse. Although PGO has new order mining rights, we are of the view that if PGO is allowed to be finally liquidated, that these rights will also lapse. And this was done and is continued to be done in concert and consultation with the major creditors, including the IDC in South Africa. The result is that there will, by virtue of the lapsing of the mining rights, be a significant devaluation of the assets of PGO and potentially dire consequences to a broad range of stakeholders. Needless to say that this will have dire consequences for a very broad range of stakeholders. One must always bear in mind when considering these matters that we are dealing with severely distressed assets and companies that are in provisional liquidation. This is not a normal run-of-the-mill type of sale of a going concern with a successful underlying business. These are distressed companies that have gone into provisional liquidation. One has to bear that in mind. The reality is that PGO and the East Rand companies support a broader community in Orkney and the East Rand area, respectively, than just the vulnerable workers. The joint provisional liquidators believe and continue to believe that it was of vital importance to administer the estate in a way that would ensure the ongoing sustainability of the operations at PGO and Kroetvlei, which would benefit the wider community and the vulnerable workers, amongst others. This task in itself was a particularly complicated one, given the quantum involved in achieving this and the varying stakeholder interests that were at play. It was necessary soon after PGO and the East Rand companies were placed in provisional liquidation to place the mines on care and maintenance to ensure that the asset value did not deteriorate during this period in which the joint provisional liquidators were looking for buyers for the assets. At the Grootvlei mine, approximately 100 milliliters of water needs to be pumped each day. 1,000 milliliters of 100,000 milliliters of water, my apologies, to be pumped each day at an approximate expense of 6.5 million rand per month. There are also significant electricity expenses associated with doing so of approximately 4 million a month. So collectively, just to pump the water on the East Rand, you need over 10.5 million rand a month. In addition, one needs to appoint security and pay employees to provide services to protect the mines and the assets. As such, the joint provisional liquidators were advised that keeping the mines on limited operations would assist to offset the huge costs associated with the aforementioned obligations, i.e. in the region of about 10.5 to 11 million per month to provide this care and maintenance service. In light of this, a decision was taken to conduct such necessary and limited mining operations under the guidance of suitably qualified professionals. Care and maintenance costs at Pomotsi Gold Orkney are approximately 2,500,000 rands per month. As can be appreciated and as has been alluded to above, the costs associated with placing a mine on care and maintenance and conducting mining operations at Grootvlei is significant. Simply put, the joint provisional liquidators did not and still do not have the requisite funds in the estate to conduct such care and maintenance and conducting mining operations, and the joint provisional liquidators thus urgently set about trying to source the necessary funds for this end. In this respect, an amount of approximately 10 million rands was recovered by us in Pomotsi Gold Orkney and utilized to fund the care and maintenance for a period of time. The administration of this process was a daunting one and required our attention on a daily basis. We were in charge of the care and maintenance operations at the mine until approximately September 2009. However, the funding soon ran out and decisions had to be made as to how best to protect the assets in the circumstances. Importantly, and despite the best efforts of the joint provisional liquidators, we were unable to obtain any further funding to do so ourselves. Notwithstanding that in respect of Pomotsi Gold Orkney, we approached the IDC for funding for care and maintenance, which the IDC refused to give, as it was their view that they were already involved to a tune of some 200 million rands with Pomotsi Orkney. The major secured creditor of the East Rand companies, the Industrial Hypovereins Bank in Germany, now commonly known as UniCredit Bank, provided the joint provisional liquidators with 50 million rands loan for this purpose pursuant to a comprehensive rand facility agreement being concluded on the 15th of May between the parties. After receiving this funding, the joint provisional liquidators placed the Grootvlei mine on care and maintenance and conduct certain limited mining operations thereat. We also paid, importantly, approximately 23 million rands from this loan to the vulnerable workers in advance settlement of their claims against the estate. Now, I wish to pause here for a moment. It is unprecedented that when a company is in provisional liquidation and not even having sold the assets and not even having a draft liquidation and distribution account, that the joint provisional liquidators would raise money to pay the very vulnerable workers an amount of 23 million. We understood the plight of the workers. They were the Pomotsi, the ex-Pomotsi workers. And in order to give them comfort, we paid their outstanding salaries and wages, which we will now reflect in any future liquidation and distribution account. From this loan, there was no obligation on the joint provisional liquidators to do so. But in the context, it was felt appropriate and UniCredit Bank agreed with the step as the major creditor. The administration of the process was a daunting one and required the joint provisional liquidators required their attention on a daily basis. We were in charge of the care and maintenance operations at the Grootvlei mines until approximately 13th of October 2009. However, the funding soon ran out and decisions had to be made as to how best to protect the assets in the circumstances. Importantly, and despite the best efforts of the JPLs, we were unable to obtain any further funding to do so ourselves. Now let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, why the funding ran out. This is a very interesting question. UniCredit Bank would have continued to fund us on a continuous basis and keep the mines on care and maintenance and on a limited operational basis if there was not a strike at those mines. There was a point when we were in charge of the mines when the unions embarked on a strike, UniCredit Bank being an overseas bank and not understanding the complexities around the labor laws in this country, called the joint provisional liquidators and said, if there's going to be continued strikes and there's going to be no production, we are not going to fund you guys anymore. And that's exactly what they did. So had there not been any strikes, we would have still been in control of the East Rand operations to this day or until such time that we found a suitable buyer. And that's when the funding was stopped and it was terminated by UniCredit Bank. Obviously, one of the other conditions of the funding was that the joint provisional liquidators had to, in the normal course, at least break even. Even if you were not making profits, at least if you broke even, you paid the salaries, you paid the wages, you protected your assets. And that is exactly what we were doing. We were not there to make a profit. But when labor downed tools and when production stopped, obviously it had a ripple effect and there was a serious cash flow crisis. And during the process, the joint provisional liquidators of the East Rand companies decided that it was necessary to launch a further application to the North Gauteng High Court Pretoria seeking the court's ratification of our earlier extension of powers or, in the alternative, to grant us the extension of powers we initially sought. It was decided that this was necessary because a concern had been raised that in law it was not permissible for someone other than the joint provisional liquidators to make such an application. Such an application was launched and the court granted the order that we sought. I now come to the tender process, exactly what we did in trying to secure a buyer. Pursuant to our respective aforementioned appointments, the JPLs of PGO and East Rand companies decided to embark on a transparent tender process to find suitable buyers for the assets as aforementioned. In this regard, we accepted tenders from certain banks in South Africa and then appointed the Standard Bank of South Africa to conduct such a transparent tender process. Standard Bank in South Africa have a specialist mining division and they were in consultation with the master and on permission from the master mandated by the joint provisional liquidators to assist us on this entire process because this was a complicated process. We were dealing with mining assets, we were dealing with mineral rights, we were dealing with all sorts of complicated environmental laws and we needed expert advice and the master approved that. So Standard Bank of South Africa was then mandated to handle the tender process. The tender process was done transparently. Adverts were placed in all the major newspapers and we invited tenders. Pursuant to the relevant tender advertisement being placed in the market, Standard Bank received applications from interested parties. Pursuant to compliance by such interested parties with the tender process terms and conditions, each party was entitled to conduct a proper due diligence investigation of Komatsu Gold, Orkney and the East Rand companies. Any party that was still interested in purchasing the assets after such due diligence was then invited to submit a formal offer or bid to Standard Bank acting on behalf of the JPLs. Discussions and negotiations took place between the parties and their advisors and us and our advisors, and at all times we consulted with the major secured creditors. We then selected Aurora Empowerment Systems as the preferred bidder. Now, I want to make it absolutely clear. There seems to be a huge amount of confusion in the media and among some of the role players as to what the preferred bidder status is. A preferred bidder status is nothing more but that. They were chosen as the preferred bidder and they were not chosen for any other reason apart from the fact that they met the criteria at the time. At all material times, the major secured creditors, the Industrial Development Corporation of South Africa at Komatsu Gold Orkney and UniCredit Bank, in respect of the East Rand companies, had been consulted and approved of the actions taken by the joint provisional liquidators. Now, of crucial importance, ladies and gentlemen, is what you are not told, is that the labor unions were consulted in this process. We had extensive meetings with NUM, and we had extensive meetings with Solidarity, and they supported supported Aurora's bid. That's what you are not told. But I need to put that on record. We have letters from NUM confirming that, and on the basis of those letters, we then extended our powers and got the permission from the master and the other major secured creditors to accept Aurora as the preferred bidder. Insofar as the offers were concerned, Aurora offered an amount of $215 million for the Pomosi Gold Orkney assets. Aurora indicated in its offer that it wished to acquire assets either by way of a sale of assets agreement being concluded or in terms of a scheme of arrangement under Section 311 of the Companies Act, or alternatively by purchasing the assets. In this regard, we relied heavily on the representations made by a Malaysian consortium through AM Equity, a BVI-registered company, which had provided a letter of funding to Aurora in terms of which it undertook to do certain things and then to pay a total of $200 million for the acquisition of PGO by Aurora upon confirmation that Aurora had been selected as the preferred bidder. The joint provisional liquidators thus were firmly of the view that Aurora was, at that time, the best candidate for the assets given their funding undertakings, their BEE credentials, and the representations made insofar as the long-term sustainability of the mine was concerned. We point out that at the time this offer was made, there were no other meaningful offers on the table. There was one other offer from Simmer and Jack, which was subsequently withdrawn. Simmer and Jack's offer for Pomosi Gold Orkney was in the region of $110 million. The joint provisional liquidators had intensive negotiations with them. We were of the view that it would be more advantageous to sell to a more recognized mining company that had a track record in this country, like we did with Harmony in the Free State. Unfortunately, there was an offer given, but one of the conditions to the offer was that Simmer and Jack would not employ any of the Pomosi employees. They would terminate all, or wanted the joint provisional liquidators to terminate all employment contracts, and then when they decided to re-employ all, they also had an idea that they would redeploy some of their own employees on these mines. And we couldn't certainly recommend that to the trade unions, because after all, what were the joint provisional liquidators doing? We were trying to save the jobs here. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been a daunting task for us. It was the easiest thing in the world for us to do, is to take final orders of liquidation, close those mines down, sell the assets, for whatever we got, and thousands of jobs would have been lost. But we didn't do that. We labored and we tried to find a buyer primarily in the interest of the general body of creditors and primarily in the interest of the employees. The joint provisional liquidators thus were firmly of the view that Aurora was at that time the best candidate for the assets given their funding undertakings, their BE credentials. We've been through that. We point out that at the time the offer was made, there was no other meaningful offers on the table, and as such accepted the Aurora offer was, and as such we accepted that the Aurora offer was in the best interest of the general body of creditors, and we approached the IDC, because you must remember one thing, ladies and gentlemen, as I earlier said, liquidators or joint provisional liquidators are not a law unto themselves. If they don't take instructions from the major secured creditors, they could be in breach of their fiduciary duties. So that at all times, we have to brief the major secured creditors, because those are the creditors that have security over these assets. It's their assets that we are dealing with. We're not dealing with our assets. We're not dealing with anybody else's assets. We have to take instructions from them. The IDC was consulted, and the IDC approved the transaction, and as I earlier said, the labor unions, in the instance of Orkney, it was NUM that was approached, and NUM's buy-in was sought, which they confirmed, and it was another union called UASA. Solidarity were not involved in Pomosi Gold Orkney, and as far as the East End operations is concerned, it is NUM, Solidarity that have the majority of the members. There was only one other bidder, but there was only one other bid that was received, as I said earlier, from Simmer and Jack in an amount of 110. However, this offer was ultimately withdrawn, and I briefed you on why this offer was withdrawn. Aurora offered an amount of 390 million rands for the assets of the East Rand companies. Aurora indicated in its offer that it wished to acquire the assets either by way of a sale of assets agreement being concluded or again in terms of a scheme of arrangement under Section 311 of the Companies Act. In this regard, the joint provisional liquidators again relied heavily on the representations made by AME, the Malaysian company, which had provided a letter of undertaking to Aurora in terms of which it undertook to pay a total of 350 million rands. The joint provisional liquidators thus were firmly of the view that Aurora was at the time the best candidate for the assets given their funding undertakings. Now, it's very interesting to note that on Eastland, we never received one other credible offer. Offers were made. Standard Bank in this country was mandated to check those offers out, and obviously we wanted suitable comfort that funding was in place. And when it came to crunch time, those offerors just didn't have the funding and they just fizzled out. What we also did, ladies and gentlemen, is in order to sift out the serious players from the jokers in this entire transaction, and one must remember, when you have mines that go into liquidation or assets that we are dealing with, you have lots of fly-by-nights and chances that come and say, we've got the funds and we will obviously want to acquire these assets. So what we did is, we imposed on all offerors a 1 million rand refundable deposit. That told us and gave us the comfort that if a person was serious or a company was serious in acquiring an asset, they would put their 1 million rand down. Some of those interested parties did not even have the 1 million rand to put down, let alone put in an offer. Joint provisional liquidators thus firmly were of the view that Aurora was at the time the best candidate for the assets given their funding undertakings. We point out that at the time this offer was made, there were no other meaningful offers on the table, and as such, accepting the Aurora offer was in the best interest of the general body of creditors, and we were supported by UniCredit Bank in this regard. We were also supported by certain of the trade unions. Pursuant to our appointments, the joint provisional liquidators agreed to allow Aurora to propose and hopefully conclude a scheme of arrangement. The necessary agreements were prepared and subject to certain information being provided by Aurora to the joint provisional liquidators. Pursuant to Aurora being selected as the preferred bidder, the joint provisional liquidators concluded two interim trading agreements, or what we call interim trading and contract mining agreements, with Aurora in respect of Pomotsi Gold Orkney and the East Rand companies, in terms of which Aurora undertook to conduct the necessary care and maintenance at the mines and certain mining operations at Grootvlei, pending the conclusion of the scheme of arrangement. Aurora is doing so at their cost and at their own risk. Aurora also has obligations to report to us and to protect the assets. Now, I want to pause here for a minute. We must bear in mind that the liquidators have no money. Here comes along Aurora with a credible funding letter from a Malaysian company that wants to invest here, and the Malaysian company, the director of the Malaysian company and shareholder, had already acquired a directorship in Aurora. Subsequently, it transpired that there was a dispute between Aurora's Malaysian counterpart over some shareholding disagreements, and that's why he exited. What did the liquidators really do here? We had no money from the IDC. We had no money from UniCredit Bank, and I've explained why. And we were sitting with assets that we could not have sufficient money to put on care and maintenance. Aurora came along and said, while we are finalizing our funding and the scheme of arrangement, we will do the care and maintenance at our own cost. We put this to the creditors. The creditors instructed us to do so, naturally, because they did not want to put any more money into this. Once again, the estates of PGO and East Rand companies do not have funds from which such costs of care and maintenance and limited mining operations can be paid without the need for an external party to provide the services. Further, the IDC and UniCredit Bank are not prepared, and there is no obligation on them to do so, to provide any further funding to the provisional liquidators. Importantly, the only source of income that could be used if such funding was given to the joint provisional liquidators is the monthly state water pumping subsidy. And the good lady from the Department of Mineral Resources was at pains to explain to you, and the JPLs concur with her view, that as long as there is no mining going on at the East Rand, there is no water subsidy. We have made that time and time again clear to Aurora. It was explained to us, the Act was explained to us, and we concurred with that. This would be in an amount of approximately $2.5 million. That's the water subsidy. In any event, this subsidy is substantially inadequate as the cost of pumping water and the treatment of such water is approximately $6.5 million and a further $4 million for electricity. We must also remember that Pamotzi, Gold, East Rand in liquidation and subsequently Aurora were the last man standing. One must not forget that there were many mining houses in the area, including Harmony, that mined there for many, many years. And what happened? They all closed their mines down, they all went away, and the pumping responsibilities fell squarely on the shoulders of Pamotzi and subsequently Aurora. We are busy investigating the causes of failure of Pamotzi. This is one of the reasons why Pamotzi failed. Not the only reason, but one of the reasons. However, the relevant department has adopted the attitude, correctly so in my view, that no mining operations being conducted and as such the mines do not qualify for the subsidy. Once you start mining, and you obviously then qualify for a water subsidy, Aurora mined until, we all know it's common knowledge that they mined there until about March 2010. Notwithstanding the foregoing funding obligations of AME, AME failed despite demand to put up the funds to enable the deals to be consummated. In this regard, the joint provisional liquidators, through our attorneys of record, Noel Hussein Lindsay Incorporated in Johannesburg, wrote to AME and placed them on terms. Unfortunately, they adopted the attitude that we must look to Aurora and not to them. In light of this, the joint provisional liquidators and the Standard Bank urgently set about attempting to source additional offers, because we realized that Aurora's funder had now reneged on the funding commitment. So we said, what option do we have? We need to go back into the marketplace and we need to re-invite offers. That's exactly what we did. We informed Aurora that we had no option but to run a parallel process to find alternate buyers for the assets with which they agreed. Frankly, Aurora didn't have an option because their funder exited. We were not there to wait indefinitely, and we said we need to find another buyer, and we need to find another buyer very quickly. Two of the JPLs, myself and Gavin Gangsford from KPMG, and I, we even flew to Germany to meet with possible funders of a buyer that was interested in and UniCredit Bank. Unfortunately, the failure by AME to comply with its obligations timelessly or at all prevented us from finalizing the documentation and moving to court to carry the necessary statutory Section 311 meetings until a new funder or bidder could be found. To the relief of all concerned, Aurora then announced in the media on the 29th of April 2010 that it had secured funding from one of the world's largest hedge funds to enable it to consummate the deal. On the 12th of May, we received from GEM Management Resources, which is a private equity fund based in Switzerland, on behalf of the hedge fund, written confirmation of the credit equity line in the amount of $725 million that was to pay to Aurora. This was sufficient funding to conclude deals on both PGO and Eastrand. However, it subsequently turned out that the funding was dependent on Labatt Africa Limited's, a JSE-listed entity, share price reaching certain values. One of the conditions that GEMS imposed on Aurora was that we're a private equity fund. We deal in stocks and in shares. We will fund you for the required amount, but you have to acquire a listed entity. So what did Aurora do? They went and they acquired Labatt Africa Limited, which we all know used to belong to our rugby fundi, Mr. Brian van Rooyen, many years ago. It was his company. They negotiated a sale with him. They acquired Labatt, and they, by so doing, had a listed entity. But because of the negative sentiments around this deal, and because of the media hype, and the media were not, in my view, incorrect in being critical of Aurora, the market sentiments against Aurora never, ever rectified itself. So what happened? The share price never reached a certain target. What GEM said is if the share price reaches a certain level, immediately the funds become unconditionally available. As matters stand, the GEM funding is still in place. It's not gone away. But it's dependent on the share price getting to a certain level. Aurora's share price can't get to that level because of what you've seen here today and the negative sentiments. And, I mean, that's the reality of the situation.
It's the Mutella affair. How far down the
I'm
line
almost,
are you? Are you almost finished?
Yes, I'm almost.
All right.
Unfortunately, the Labatt share price has still not reached the anticipated threshold, and as a result, Aurora has not been able to draw down sufficient funds. It should also be borne in mind that it is a far more complex issue than simply kicking Aurora off the mines. There are many stakeholder interests at play, and very importantly, a dire lack of finance. It is true that if the deals with Aurora were cancelled, the joint provisional liquidators may have huge damages claims against Aurora. Make no mistake, once and if these deals are cancelled, we have sufficient recourse in terms of our interim trading and contract mining agreement to proceed against Aurora, and I'm going to say this publicly, even proceed against the directors of Aurora in terms of Section 424 of the Companies Act for Reckless Trading. Not only the directors of Aurora, but the Companies Act, and particular Section 424, is wide enough for us to deal with even the management of Aurora. However, that does not resolve the more immediate need to finance care and maintenance at the mines in the interim. In short, without the necessary interim funding, huge disasters may occur, and this would probably fall to the state to fund. Of course, if any entity were to provide the funding to enable the JPLs to remove Aurora from the mine, and indeed if it made sense to all parties concerned to do so, we would not hesitate to take the necessary action. In this respect, we even invited organized labor to say, you have funds available, make funds available for care and maintenance, which is a first charge against the administration of the estate, that you will get paid first before the secured creditors, and we will kick Aurora out tomorrow. The interim trading and contract mining agreement allows us to do this. Again, I reiterate that we are not dealing with a successful business where lots of bidders are in fact queuing to buy the assets. These are severely distressed assets with companies in provisional liquidators. Now we come to the other funders. Pursuant to the JPLs and Standard Bank's further investigations for offers, a Chinese consortium called Grand TG was introduced to us. Now, Grand TG was introduced to us through a lady called Mrs. Hetty Furie that represents a company called the VAM Consortium. We and our advisors had detailed and lengthy discussions with this consortium. Grand TG eventually made offers for PGO and the Eastrand companies, which was subsequently amended and which we discussed with the secured creditors. However, the consortium did not put up the funding, and I repeat that, they never put up the funding, to enable us to consummate the deal, and their offer contained numerous onerous conditions, many of which are particularly onerous, and some of which the joint provisional liquidators could never fulfill. We would never have the powers to do so. The PGO offer was significantly lower than the original offer from Sima and Jack, which was later withdrawn by them, and furthermore, it was a condition to this offer that once this Chinese consortium, now not the current Chinese consortium of Aurora, but Grand TG, that once they had taken possession of the mines, and they had a very onerous condition that once they did their investigations, they could reduce the purchase price on those mines to whatever they wished they wanted to reduce. So effectively, they could reduce it to 1 rand and we could do nothing about it. The offer price for the Eastern companies was also approximately 260 million, less than Aurora's offer price, and furthermore, it was also a condition to this offer that once the consortium were in possession of the mine, that they conducted a further due diligence and the offer price could be reduced. We were surprised by this, given the original assurances by the consortium that they would definitely not reduce the Aurora prices and would even give an offer in excess of Aurora's offer. As a result, we concluded that this offer was not in the best interest of all creditors and that reduction in the offer price could be substantial, and there was great uncertainty in this respect as to what this reduction could be. Furthermore, the secured creditors did not support the offers. Fortunately, towards the end of last year, a second Chinese-based entity, and I dare say that I have been asked in the past, and I've been recorded in the media, not to name this Chinese entity, but because this matter has come to a head, I'm going to take the liberty to mention who that Chinese company is, the famous Chinese company that's now, we believe, coming to the rescue of Aurora. Shandong Gold expressed serious interest in funding Aurora to enable it to conclude the transaction to acquire the assets of PGO and the Eastrand companies. In this regard, Shandong sent a senior delegation to South Africa to have discussions with the JPLs and to inspect the mine. Pursuant to this visit, Shandong appointed PricewaterhouseCoopers in Beijing to conduct a high-level due diligence on Pomotri Gold Orkney and the East Rand companies and their assets. We have been assisting, as the JPL, the PwC, with information to enable them to finalize the due diligence. We met on the 23rd of March 2011 with Mr. Michael Hulley of Aurora, who assured us that the PwC due diligence was well on track and likely to be completed by mid-April, whereafter the report would be made available to Shandong to enable it to finalize its shareholder and state asset approval. Now, in this respect, I'm going to take the liberty of reading the original letter that we received from Shandong on the 24th of November. It's addressed to the JPL and it says, Acquisition of Assets, Aurora Empowerment Systems, Shandong Gold Group. We are a Chinese-based company listed on the Shanghai Stock Exchange as well as the Shenzhen Stock Exchange and have been rated as one of China's 100 best-growing listed companies. We own in excess of 20 large gold mines in China and Asia as well as other assets in other parts of the world. Over the past 4 months, we have been in negotiation with Aurora with a view to acquiring an interest in Aurora and in so doing, the assets currently in provisional liquidation. This has meant extensive discussions, consultations, inspections, sampling, and due diligence with a view to finalizing the acquisition. We are intent on finalizing the agreement with Aurora when our team will be present later in December and hosted by Aurora. We have made available an amount of US$100 million in order to ensure that there are sufficient funds to commit to the transaction. To this end, we have requested our bankers to provide proof of funds in respect of US$100 million and in due course the necessary financial bank guarantees in respect of the finalized amount will be made available. We undertake to give our full cooperation to any local financial institution appointed by the JPLs in order that our credentials may be verified, and we asked Standard Bank to verify the credentials and the report we got back was very, very encouraging. Despite the challenges which Aurora has faced in finalizing the transaction, we are committed to partnering with them in building a sustainable business through the application of capital and our extensive experience in the gold resources sector. Likewise, we are mindful of the local regulatory framework within which such an entity operates. The purpose of this communication is to ensure you of our intention to consummate this transaction with the necessary capital injection that this will entail. It was signed by the chairman of the board. Subsequently, a few days later, we received a certificate from their bankers, and this is what it says. This letter is because we requested proof that the funds were available. The letter is one thing. We needed proof from the bank that the funds were there. It says, this letter serves to confirm that based on the funds held at our institution, together with other reserves and investments, the Shandong Gold Group Company has a credit line of $100 million for the proposed transaction with Aurora Empowerment Systems. 22nd of February of this year, we received a further updated letter from them, and on the 8th of April, we received a further letter, and again on the 12th of April, we received a further letter informing us that a senior delegation is now coming to South Africa within the next 2 weeks to complete the outstanding queries and due diligence, whereafter they will consummate this deal. It is on these undertakings and these letters that I, on behalf of the Joint Provisional Liquidators, at the meeting that we had with Mr. Michael Hulley, made it absolutely clear to Mr. Hulley that whilst the JPLs have an extension of the provisional winding up orders on both PGO and East Rand up to the 16th of August, we are not going to wait until the 16th of August, and I'll tell you why. There is a fallacy and a myth that the Joint Provisional Liquidators extended the provisional winding up orders until August merely to give Aurora another opportunity. We have no other buyer. We are trying to rescue this deal with Aurora. Those are the instructions of the secured creditors. But we are also running out of patience. And we've made it very clear to Aurora that if Shandong doesn't give us a firm commitment that by the 31st of May, their shareholders have approved the deal and the State Council in China has approved the deal. Now, we have a subsequent letter, which I don't want to bore you with, which we requested, and Shandong said that we have now got our board approval on the deal. The only outstanding issues is PwC Beijing's report, whereafter we will put this to our shareholders, and if the board has approved it, it is understood that this won't be a problem with the shareholders, but you know, things can go either way. And because all resources companies in China are state-owned companies, they have to get the rubber stamp of the government. They have to get the state council's approval. So that's all that's outstanding. We have indicated to Mr. Hali and Mr. Mandela that if we do not get, at least by the 31st of May, shareholder approval from Shandong and state council approval, we will consider cancelling the interim trading and contract mining agreement with Aurora, and then it gives us enough time until the 16th of August to then break up the assets or find another buyer. We do not have another buyer. It'll be a sad day if we have to do that, because thousands of jobs would be lost. Just to conclude, sorry, I'm coming to that. There's one other aspect that I need to deal with you. There was mention made of Virgile Asia Mine. I dealt with the Chinese. Insofar as an alternative bidders are concerned, an offer was made by Virgile Asia Mining Limited, which is Hetty Furi's company, SCC Mandarin Financial Services, and Galaxy Asset Management Limited, the VAM Consortium as they're commonly known, on the 11th of March for the assets of Komochi Gold Orkney for $11 million. In this regard, our transaction advisor, the Standard Bank of South Africa, is awaiting the formal letter of confirmation regarding the availability of Hong Kong dollars $100 million for the proposed transaction, which will also cover a further $3 million for care and maintenance. A response was sent to the VAM consortium thanking them for their offer, but requesting them to reconsider saying insofar as the quantum is concerned before the offer could be presented to the IDC. The reason for that is all that money will go to the IDC. There will be no money for the concurrent creditors on Orkney and absolutely no money for the workers' claims. So if we get a slightly higher offer, at least we can give the workers a reasonable dividend and give the concurrent creditors something. Pursuant to this, VAM sent a further revised offer, now in the total amount of $110 million. We are in the process of considering this offer. In particular, we are very carefully considering whether there are any onerous conditions attached to this offer, bearing in mind that it was a similar consortium that was associated with Hetty Furi that had put previously onerous conditions on us. In this regard, you will recall that previously Grand TG sought to include extremely onerous conditions in their offer, which enable them, for example, to ex post facto reduce the purchase price. Nonetheless, we will discuss the offer with the major secured creditor, the IDC, but we are of the view that it is unlikely that the IDC will consider an offer at least under $150 million, because at least $100 million will go to the IDC, and the $50 million we can utilize to pay the workers and some of the concurrent creditors. Balancing the stakeholder interest, this is in conclusion, we have been engaging continuously with Aurora, the secured creditors, and organized labor in respect of the status of the transactions. We have also been liaising with certain state departments. In this regard, and by way of summary of the most recent events, the IDC and UniCredit still wish to conclude transactions with Aurora, but are considering alternative investors. Mr. Hali assured us on the 23rd of March of this year that the security at the mines is under control and that appropriate security is on site to protect the assets. Mr. Hali also informed us on the 23rd of March that comprehensive reports would be furnished to us, which reports will deal with the water treatment, pumping, refurbishment of pumps, and staff-related issues, which Mr. Hali assured us was all under control. I'm pleased to tell you that as of yesterday, those reports were given to us. The joint provisional liquidators will now meet, consider those reports. Arising out of those reports, if there's any questions, we will pose it to them. We received a report in respect of PGO on Monday, the 11th of April, and are still working through it. A report in respect of East Rand Mines was received by us on the 12th. We are in the process of working through this. Mr. Hali also informed us at the meeting on the 20th of March.
Shala, we've gone beyond the permissible time. I thought you were winding up.
I'm just about to.
Let's agree that whatever is remaining there in terms of suggestions that you wanted to make, together with your presentation, you're going to send it through.
Yes, absolutely.
And let's also secondly agree that the other liquidators who constitute the JPL,
six of them,
will also confirm that submission. and so that it is not an environmentalist submission.
No, if I may just interrupt you, this submission has been approved and confirmed by all the JPLs.
Very well.
In fact, I signed it off on behalf of all the JPLs.
Very well, very well. We didn't want to do this to you, but unfortunately we ran out of time. And apart from just breaking for lunch, members have got interactions between now and 2 o'clock.
I understand the time limit was for 1 o'clock.
So I would ask you to stop there.
Yes, I will.
And that we agree that, one, you will send us that information not later than the end of business on Tuesday, the 19th of April.
I will try and send this to you first thing tomorrow.
First thing tomorrow?
Yes.
Take the contact details
of
the secretary here. Now, advise us if we are to write directly to the other liquidators.
Yes.
Because we want them to come back here when we resume this interaction. And honorable members, we've run out of time. And as a result, we had thought that we are going to have an opportunity to ask questions to the presenters. We won't be able to do that. We will have to reschedule, most probably for the 3rd of June. I will confer with my co-chairperson here. The reason that we're talking of the 3rd of June is because towards the end of April and May, that period is gone. We are finishing here. The last day in Parliament is the 21st of April. The first day back in Parliament is the 23rd of May. I'm not going to recognize you. Put your hand down, please, sir. Is the 23rd of May when we come back. Reasonably thinking, you can do nothing between the 21st of April and the 23rd of May. That's the agreed program with all parties involved. So, therefore, the first opportunity which would have taken care of budget votes, for instance, we, as Mineral Resources, are debating on the 1st of June. Now, the first opportunity will be the 3rd of June, where we want all parties involved here to again come back to Parliament. And it's not only you that must give us your submission in writing, Mr. Mutala. It is also Aurora itself. They've made an undertaking that the input that they made here will be given to us in writing. We want to take all those inputs that were given by all parties concerned here, analyze them, raise questions, and then possibly on that day conclude on the way forward, because we would have thought through the entire process in terms of what we have had. So possibility is that until, if there's a change, you will get the notification letter that says there's a change. But for now, we're meeting on the 3rd of June back here in Parliament. You will be given confirmation letters in terms of venues and other matters. The other matter that we would like to place on record is that in all these efforts, firstly, we're looking at how do we resolve the immediate problem of the payment of the money is owed to the working people in both mines, in Optimine and in Crossley. Secondly, we need to put all our best efforts in place so that we save the plus 5,000 jobs that are currently under threat. And if things go according to the way you are explaining, Mr. Otala, and the way in which Aurora is explaining, we create more jobs. But it must be decent jobs, which include the fact that if it's a job, it must be a paying job and on time. So therefore, we would have to then nudge all those that are involved, government departments, including the Department of Labor, Mineral Resources, Justice, and whoever else is concerned, so that we come out with, we emerge with a solution that will put paid to the real goals that we're looking at. And indeed, whatever decision we take will be to basically close off any possible loophole so that an episode of this nature is not repeated elsewhere, not only in mining sector, but also in other sectors across our economy. And lastly, we would want to give this assurance to the workers in both mines, as well as to the unions, both NUM and Solidarity, as well as to the communities that are affected in the areas where this mining is taking place, that we have had your plight as you raised it with us. And Parliament have started a process of dealing with the issue. And we've made this undertaking even in those public hearings, that this Parliament, being an activist Parliament under the leadership of the African National Congress, we are not going to look the other way when matters of this nature are raised with us. We've demonstrated that by this meeting, firstly today, and we're demonstrating that by the fact that on the 3rd of June, we will handle the matter head on and emerge with a workable solution. With those few words, we would want to adjourn so that you don't lose out on your other appointments and your lunch. I'm not going to allow questions and comments, because if I give one honorable member, it means I must open it to everybody else. Therefore, we adjourn until...
Chairperson, sorry. I don't want to ask a question, Chairperson.
Yes.
I want to ask reconsideration.
Oh.
What I'm asking you, Chairperson, I hear what you say about the 3rd of June. Surely rules of Parliament provides that in a very extreme case that the portfolio can meet. And I want to ask reconsideration. You are the chair. You know, 3rd of June, there are people outside there, they don't receive salaries, they can't buy food. I see this is a real priority, and I ask the reconsideration that you as chairperson consult with the speaker that an earlier date than the 3rd of June can be established, because this is a really urgent matter. I ask reconsideration. Thank you, Chair.
I think the point you are making is well taken. We are not going to wait until the 3rd of June in engaging the relevant bodies. For instance, there's a matter to pursue with the Department of Labor on the outstanding monies that must be paid. This whole thing of tracing workers, they are saying here on record that they still have some money that must still be paid. They are saying here on record that by the 18th, another compliance order will be issued, which means that another list of people will be submitted, and that we don't think that the joint liquidators and provisional liquidators and Aurora are going to wait until that time before they comply with that compliance order. So I'm saying, therefore, in between, there are things that we will do. And then on the 3rd of June, we'll be applying our minds properly in terms of taking a proper decision. But the request you are putting, we're going to approach the parliamentary leadership in the form of the Speaker, the Chief Whip, and yourselves in your parties, because there is a standing agreement between parties that no meetings will be allowed during this constituency period, given the fact that we are into the elections. It's in writing. So therefore, you have taken that decision as parties, as chief whips of parties, that this must be the situation. So we'll do that request, but then we wouldn't close our eyes on the fact that we did receive that correspondence, and therefore our planning must be in line with that directive that we did receive. But we will, if there's any change, that's why I said that if there's any change, we will then communicate in writing to everybody to say that it's no longer the 3rd of June, it's before the 3rd of June, and then, of course, we will engage on the subject matter. Mr. Chairman,
if I may, just there is a suggestion I have, which was made to the labor union, Solidarity in particular, and NUM, by the JPLs already a year ago. One of the things that we can do to assist as JPLs is, as you know, these companies are in provisional liquidation, so the law is very clear. Once a company is in provisional liquidation, employment contracts are suspended and cannot be terminated. But we can approach court. And I made this suggestion to Mr. Nika Rakau, who's sitting right at the back window, and I made this to Mr. Kidjan Duplessis at a meeting where he had with the JPLs to say, let us approach court together with the unions, asking for an order, a declarator order, to say that we are allowed as JPLs to temporarily cancel the employment contracts until such time that Aurora comes up with their funding or another buyer is found. That will give the many employees urgent reprieve in that they will be able to claim their UIF. As matters stand, they can't claim UIF because their contracts of employment are merely suspended. We have had no response from organized labor on this.
That's the matter that, parties must negotiate and deal with. Our situation here is to address what is owed to workers and to address their future situation. So I think pursue that matter with the relevant parties. We will not interfere in that at all. And you can give us a report back around the time when we meet again. Honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
And a message for the workers, if you say, the miners,
have you finalized a shareholding agreement with Shandong?
Not at this stage.
Thanks.
What kind of people do you find in the office?
No, I don't.
Okay.